Of course, actually, it's not that long. It always seems long time. We've only been gone for a month now, which is a very short time in the face of eternity. We think what we're dealing with here in the Dhamma is the eternal. We are seeking out, like all religious aspirants, we're seeking out the eternal, the lasting, that which doesn't change, which doesn't fade away. We're trying to attain that state of security, which is free from the danger of uncertainty. This is the eternal and lasting state. So, 1 month is actually meaningless. The past is gone, the future hasn't come, and it will always be only so. What's true and real is the present moment. What's eternal is here and now. And this is really what the Satipatthana Sutta is trying to impress upon us. It's trying to bring us to see the present moment, to see the here and the now, which is always right in front of us. No? It's the one thing that we don't want to see, and the one thing that we fail to appreciate, fail to understand. We're very good at even coming to understand very difficult things, to things that are very difficult to understand, as long as they're abstract and removed from the mundane. So we will study the sciences, we will study philosophy, study all sorts of subjects. But we're very poor at studying ourselves. So this is what we're aspiring towards in our practice of mindfulness. So as again, this study course is supposed to be an immersive study course, just like when you study French immersion. You learn the subject, but you also gain the language, the language of the subject. So my voice and the text in front of you, this is there's two parts to it. There is the knowledge that it's imparting, the intellectual knowledge, and the meaning, the atta. Atta is the meaning of the text. But then there's also the Dhamma, which is the experience itself. So the sound of the voice and the light coming from your computer screen, and the mind which is comprehending and is considering the text. So at the same time, if we use this as an immersive study course, then at the same time as we're studying the meaning, we can also study the Dhamma. The meaning being the intellectual understanding, and the Dhamma, at least in this sense, the meaning is intellectual, and the Dhamma is the medium of imparting the knowledge. And the medium is actually what the knowledge is all about. So if you scroll down, you'll see in orange it says, "We are here." And this is right after the Anapanasati Bhava, the section on the Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, which we completed last time. So just to recap, we are studying the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness, and we finished the introduction, and we've now finished the first section of on the body, which is on mindfulness of breathing. But the body has several sections in the sutta. So the next sutta is on the four iriyapata, which are the postures of the body. And it's a very simple section. And this is really the great thing, from my point of view anyway, of the commentaries. And from traditional Buddhist point of view of the commentaries, is how great they are at taking a very, very simple, seemingly simplistic inconsequential passage and turning it into something very important, which in fact this is. This section is incredibly important. And its importance, I think, has to be explained in terms of the goal and our aspiration in the practice. Because meditation can very easily become, especially meditation of the sort that we learned about in the first section, the mindfulness of breathing section, can become a hobby or a pastime, a escape or a retreat from reality. So we will put all of our effort into the formal meditation practice, but then when we stop meditating, we give it up and we're not mindful. So during our daily lives, during the rest of our lives, we're not engaged in the meditation practice. And there's people who believe that this is adequate. It's clear that the commentators didn't believe so, as I'll try to point out based on the commentarial text. And the reason why I think it's certainly not appropriate to think so is because, as I said, of the motivation for the practice, or the goal that we're striving for. The goal is the understanding of reality. And it's certainly arguable that the understanding of reality is best done in quiet, in seclusion, just as physical scientific studies are best done in a laboratory that is secluded from distractions and from contaminants and so on. You want laboratory conditions, which is what anapanasati is, and meditations like that are good for. But the danger is that you then become partial, and that you compartmentalize reality, so that you come to see it as a different state of being, that the meditation is somehow special. And so when you attain some state of calm and tranquility, you'll come to see that as somehow preferable to the rest of experience. And you know, if you have the time to devote yourself to just that practice, or if you were able to just sit still for days and days and weeks and months on end, then that would really be fine, because that would be reality. But when your reality includes things like eating, no, which I think for most of us it does, going to the toilet, showering, or even working and looking after your family and so on, having a job and study and so on. Then your practice has to encompass all of those things as well. Even when using the computer, our practice has to eventually encompass that as well. That we're mindful at least of our mind states and the emotions that arise, even better, aware of the physical, what we're doing at the moment, of even looking at the computer screen or using the computer. This is our reality, and if if we focus too much attention on a certain aspect of a reality, for instance, the portion of our lives that is a formal meditation practice, then it's not a risk, it's a general trend, is to compartmentalize reality and become partial towards the states of experience that arise in meditation, because they tend to be more peaceful and pleasant than those outside of meditation. So for some people this is acceptable and reasonable, and I don't want to be misunderstood that somehow I'm against formal meditation practice or trivializing it, because it isn't trivial. It's in fact incredible that the formal meditation practice, and especially intensive formal meditation practice, is incredibly important for the development of insight. It's just that, considering that it's not all of our lives, we would be going against the goal of understanding reality to neglect the rest of reality. For instance, the walking aspect of reality. Gacchanto va gacchamiti pajanati. And this passage is often cited as support for the use of words or labels, in a sense, or reminders. I don't want to use labels because it's really a pejorative sense. The reminder, this active reminder. But the commentary says something that's really useful, and I don't want it to make it sound like I'm relying on the commentaries, because actually I don't think I rely on the commentaries, and I don't think traditional Buddhists rely on the commentaries. We refer to them, and we appreciate them, and we admire them, because when we do study them, they provide insight, and they provide clarification. They provide us with extra knowledge and mindfulness, and they straighten out some of our misunderstandings, our partialities, our favoritisms, our views, and so on. So, the commentary on this sentence explains that what is meant here is not some simple understanding. And actually this is borne out by the verb, which is bhajanati. Bhajanati means knows thoroughly. It's a verb that's used especially for meditation. But it's important. And it's important to help us to understand what we mean by meditation. Meditation isn't just sitting down, closing your eyes, and watching stuff. It's not just watching. Watching is not meditation. And the commentary makes this clear by saying, well, when dogs walk, they're perfectly capable of knowing that they're walking. When they stand, they're perfectly capable of knowing that they're standing. So this knowledge can arise in even animals. They can know what they're doing. But meditation doesn't arise. And because it's not meditative, it gives rise to perception of a self, the perception of possession, and being, this being me that's going, and my going. I want to go, and therefore I go. It is my body that's going, and it's a body, it's an entity that exists continuously. So this ordinary knowledge doesn't help us, really. And it's what many people take to be meditation, and therefore their meditation leads them to come to some idea of self or soul or some preferable state of existence where they experience something the true self or the true state of being, the eternal state of being, or so on, and so on. Because they're just watching, because they're not knocking out, as the commentary says, knocking out the perception of a soul, of a self. Because it doesn't do away with their views. If you, like Mahasi Sayadaw, his description of it is, if you put green sunglasses on a horse, then it will eat dry grass, thinking that it's alive. And so the point being that our views taint the very practice that we do. Just as the horse, if you put sunglasses on a horse, I don't know if it's actually true and if it actually happens, but this is what his comparison. That if you're looking at it from you know, the rose-colored glasses, as we say, then it'll all look special and it will be all tinted based on that. So it's not correct to say that you can just watch and look and you'll see. What has to be done is the straightening of the mind. And so this is what the word pajanati means. And the commentary to this section goes into quite some detail, actually. It explains this whole idea of using the present tense verb gachami that says I go. Gachami means I am going. But it's nitpicking really, because the Pali is composed of just one verb, gachami. Well, there's no word I used at all in the sentence. If there were the word ahang in there, ahang gachami, then you might have a problem, because ahang, the usage of the word ahang when it's not needed, would be emphasizing the subject instead of emphasizing the verb. But here is there's the emphasis on the verb, the act of going, and the usage of the first person tense is just grammatically correct. So I don't think it's necessary to really explain why there's the use of I go instead of this body is going, or something like that, or as someone said, this is the arising of the air element, the oscillation process, or something like that. That's not necessary. What is necessary is to understand the object for what it is, in the simplest possible way. It's not to find some spiritual or mystical or metaphysical reality or characteristic of it. It's just simply to see it as it is. Because when you say gachami, or in English we say walking, when you say walking, it's the reminder that this is walking. It's that which cuts through the me, the mine, the I, the good, the bad, and so on. Cuts through the views. It leaves no room for any sort of extrapolation or projection on the object. That's why we call it mindfulness, because the mind is full. You're fully aware, pajanati. And you're fully aware, gachami. You're fully aware of that movement. And this is important. This is an important indicator that the Buddha didn't require any kind of theoretical or exactitude, any theoretical exactitude in our meditation practice. Like, you don't have to see this is the air element, this is the earth element, and so on. Because it's all right there. When you say gachami, that is the air element. It's the motion. And it can also be the fire element if it feels you know, breezy when you move your foot. When you move, you feel a little bit cool. When you put down on the floor, you'll feel cold or hot depending on the floor. You'll feel hardness or softness. So it's the elements. And That's all encompassed by saying gacchami, or by saying, for instance, if you break it up, by saying lifting or by saying placing. And this is how the commentary explains it. The commentary says, what you're really doing is when you say gacchami, is focusing on ultimate reality or pieces of reality. As the Visuddhimagga says, the Visuddhimagga takes up this sutta and the commentary and says, understanding impermanence can be done on many levels. You can understand impermanence in terms of, I was young before and now I'm getting older and soon I'll be really old and then I'll die. Or you can understand it in terms of year by year. This year I'm different from last year. Next year I'll be different from this year. Or you can understand it in terms of days. No, this today I'm different from yesterday, and tomorrow I'll be different. Or you can understand it this morning, this afternoon, this evening, and so on and so on. And you can break it down into from piece to piece to piece, all the way to the point where you can break the walking step, up into pieces and see it arising and ceasing, and understand through watching, through this empirical observation of the movements of the foot, that things are arising and ceasing. And at that point, it's no longer intellectual. It's actually, at none of these times, it should be intellectual. It's a realization that comes, oh, I'm different now, or this, that is ceased and gone away. But it's most clear at the moment of breaking up the breath, you know, in breaths from the out breaths, or the pieces, movements of the feet. You know. So the commentary actually suggests breaking the step up into six parts. You have the lifting up of the foot, and then the stabilizing of the foot, then the moving of the foot forward, and then the lowering of the foot, and then the touching of the foot to the floor, and then the placing one's weight on that foot. And so we actually do this in our meditation courses. In the videos I put out, we only show the first walking step, but when people come here, we actually take them up on this and have them break it up into pieces. So you have Udharana, Atiharana, Vitiharana, Vosajjana, Sanikepana, Sanirumbana. In the Pali, which is lifting heel, when you lift the heel up, lifting when you lift the whole foot up, moving when you move the foot forward, lowering when you lower the foot, touching when you touch the toes, and pressing when you press the foot against the floor. And the commentary explains that the feelings, the sensations, the experiences in each of these six movements are different and are individual. The sensations, the experiences in lifting your heel don't transfer into the lifting of the foot. And so in the beginning, if you don't practice meditation, you think that this is my foot moving. No, the foot is moving through the whole step. But actually, when you break it up, you see that actually it's sensations arising and ceasing. And the sensations in one moment don't pass on to the next moment. They're actually different and individual and distinct. And the commentary also mentions one other thing that's interesting that's not really encompassed by this foundation. It's not involved with the body, but it points out that the reason we understand the body not to be me and to be mine, which is the important point of this whole sutta, is the realization that these things are natural and based on cause and effect. So it points out the causes of the movement, that the movement Sometimes, well, actually, sometimes the mind is the cause for the body, and sometimes the body is the cause for the mind. So sometimes you'll want to stand up and then you stand up. Sometimes you'll stand up and then you realize that you're standing up. There will arise the awareness of the standing up. The walking, it comes from an intention. If the intention isn't there, then the walking doesn't occur. Right? And the commentary points out this actually is an important meditation practice, which we actually do. So when you want to walk, we say to ourselves, wanting to walk, being aware of aware of that as a reality. Saying to yourself, wanting to walk, reminding yourself, or keeping yourself with the reality of that experience. The point being, if you don't do that, then you start to see, oh, I'm in control and I'm moving my feet, right? This is me wanting to do it. But if you're aware even of that wanting and experience it as an object, you'll see that it arises of its own accord as well. And then it ceases. And when it ceases, then there is the movement. Or sometimes there is not. Sometimes you say to yourself, wanting to move, and then you don't move. It can happen. But the point being that you come to see that really what exists is states of mind and states of body. So the bodily phenomena and the mental phenomena. And these arise and cease, and you see them coming and going. It also points out that the body doesn't move, the body doesn't go. So when we talk about the body going, it's actually not true. Just as a ship doesn't go by itself, but it's impelled by the wind, or a cart doesn't move, it's impelled by the horses. So in the same way, the body doesn't move by itself, it's impelled by the mind. So when you walk, it's because of the mind wanting to walk. And this is one of the first things we'll test for meditators. When a person comes to meditate, the first thing we'll test is whether they can see the difference between body and mind, whether they can see that that's all that there is only physical and mental processes, because this is what they'll see, and when they watch the foot moving, when they watch the stomach moving, and so on, and whether they can see the cause and the effect. They can see the mind leading to the body and the body leading to mind. These are the first two stages of knowledge that the Visuddhimagga talks about. The first one being the discerning body from mind, the second one being able to see the causal relationship between the two. And then the commentary has something else interesting. I'm just going by the commentary here, but it's quite interesting. It explains what is walking. You know, walking is the oscillation process, this spreading out of the air element, the pressure element. Pressure changes. And it actually seems quite silly from a modern scientific point of view. We think, oh, these are, how quaint, this talk about the four elements, which was discarded by the Greeks, or was kept by the Greeks, was discarded after the Greeks. I don't know. Nobody understands the four elements, and so they think it was a silly... When we learn in science, we learn how that was what people thought matter was made of, and how quaint that is. And then later on, we realize that's not true, that actually it's made up of atoms. And then we realize that that's not even true, that atoms are made up of subatomic particles. Until now, we realize that subatomic particles don't even exist. Sometimes they're particles, sometimes they're waves. And pretty soon we'll come back and say, hey, guess what? It's all just the four elements, because that's all that it is. The point isn't that these people were ignorant of atoms, though they may very well have been ignorant of atoms, which is funny because atoms don't really exist. The point is that they were looking at it from a whole different point of view, and the Buddha had an incredible, profound understanding of reality that is totally removed from modern scientific understanding. It's totally different subject. The Buddha's understanding was in terms of experience. It had no interest in breaking up reality into its, breaking up the physical into its smallest component parts, even though I believe that it does, the Buddha did, or there's somewhere it talks about the smallest element of matter and so on, which is fine, but the by far the focus is far more on the elements, which are not some simplistic explanation of physical reality, of physical matter. They're an explanation of the experience of it. And the experience of walking is the wind element, the pressure element, the change in the pressure. So the pressure was in one place, and now the pressure extends. The pressure arises in the legs and extends the leg out. So there's this feeling of the rippling effect of the pressure. You feel the pressure going through the leg and moving to the foot. It talks about how standing is, when you go to stand up and you know that you're standing up, it's the unfolding of the body. And this description of the body, the movements of the body, is actually quite interesting, because only for the reason that we're so ignorant of these realities, we never really thought about what does it mean to stand up, right? We say, oh, now I'm standing up. But actually, standing up is an unfolding of the body, and that's all that there is. It's the spinal column straightening out. You know? And it's the pelvic joints moving and so on. And it's all these feelings and pressures and so on that arise from that. Sitting down is where you fold your body again, and lying down is where you place your body horizontal to the floor. I mean, it's such, if you read the commentary, it's such a simplistic and seemingly superfluous, redundant or extraneous explanation, a waste of words, really. But it's not. It reminds us, what are we talking about here? We're not talking about I walk, I sit, I lie. We're talking about that reality, which is quite unknown to us, unfamiliar to us, even though we do these things every day. And so this is one of the first things that we have meditators practice. Once they've gotten familiar with formal meditation, then we have them practice meditation on these four postures. So when they walk, we have them say to us, walking, walking. When they stand, we have them say, standing, standing. When they sit down, we have them say, sitting, sitting. And when they lie down, we have them say, lying, lying. Being aware of these four postures. And pointing these out is quite useful, because obviously there are unlimited postures that we could possibly be in. And I was once asked, I went to this meditation center and they asked us, trick question, how many postures of the body are there? And me with my profound, understanding of the scriptures, I said four. You know, I walked right into it, basically. I said, there's four postures of the body. And he kind of laughed. Someone else said six. I don't know where they got six from. But then he said, oh, now we got a problem. Four, one person says four, one person says six. So now we got a fight. Which one is it, four or six? And then he said, actually, there are unlimited postures of the body. And this we can point out if you look here. I'm going to post a comment. This is called the minor postures. So when he seemed to not like my answer of four, I thought, well, maybe there's two, because there are the major postures and the minor postures. So the major postures are four. That's correct. But the minor postures are unlimited. Minor postures being any movements of the body. And I'm sorry, actually, it's not just in this section, it's in the next section as well. But the word iriyapata doesn't have to just mean the four iriyapata, the standing, walking, sitting, and lying down. Because of what the Buddha says, yata yata va panasa kayo panihito. Panihito means scent. It's used in a specific term, specific sense here, means deportment, or however your body is set or positioned. Tata tata nang pajanati. He knows that. Knows it in that way. Knows it thus. And so, and the point being that you would, so if you're squatting down, you would say squatting, or if you're reclining, you would say reclining, or so on. Or, meaning that these four are really just examples. When you bend, you can say there's a bending, when you stretch, stretching. But we'll talk about that. That's actually in the next section. And we'll try to get through the next section as well tonight. Okay, so these four, but the point is that the four major postures are still useful and very important to remember, because they're the accepted, agreed upon, conventionally understood postures of the body. And sometimes you're standing, sometimes you're walking, sometimes you're sitting, and sometimes you're lying down. We do squat at times and we do lean at times, but in general we're in one of these four postures. And so why they're useful is that they provide the fence posts for us to fill in the gaps. If you don't know what else to be mindful of, you can be mindful of your posture. Right? Like now all three of us are sitting here, but we're all sitting differently. But you can still call it sitting. And so if I had to be clear about my posture, I would say, well, I've crossed my legs and so on, and I'm leaning against the chair. But otherwise I can just say to myself, sitting. And to make it easy and to give myself, because it doesn't matter, the word isn't important, but when you say sitting, your mind immediately clears up and is aware, yes, this is a pressure in the back and a pressure in the body and so on. This experience, it's aware of that experience and it's clear about that experience that it is what it is, and it sees it arise, it sees it cease. And meditator in this way begins to see what is really there. It seems so ridiculous, actually. When people hear about this kind of meditation, they think, obviously someone's been paying too much attention to the commentaries, is what they normally say. And so they've got this theoretical understanding of what meditation should be, instead of just going out and watching and seeing and so on, which is really unfortunate, because, as I said, meditation is work. It's something that you have to practice. It's like ironing out metal. If you have this piece of metal that's bent out of shape, you have to pound it again and again and again to straighten it. And this is, the Buddha was very clear in the Dhammapada. He says, the wise straighten their mind, just as fletchers straighten the arrows, and the people who work with water straighten the water or make the water go through the pipes and so on. We're working to straighten our minds, and it's real work. It's something that you have to work at. And so when you do this, when you say to yourself sitting or however the words you use to describe the experience, it accomplishes that task in that moment. And the continued practice of this is like the continued beating of the iron until it becomes straight. Okay, so that's the section on the modes of deportment or the postures of the body. Next we come on to Sampajana Pabba. And the commentary goes into quite some detail in this section that I'm not going to do. But I would encourage you to read the commentary, because it's not dry, it's actually quite fun. If you read the book called The Way of Mindfulness, it's the commentary, the sutta and the commentary on it in English. Very good book. But it's good to break these things down, and it's good to understand clearly what we're talking about and to think about these, consider these things, so that we're clear. Yeah, I do that. I go forward, I go back. So the next time we do it, we remember, we think about this sutta. Next time we walk, next time we walk back and forth, next time we turn our heads to look, next time we bend, next time we stretch, and so on. So this is the first aspect of this. The first thing to say is that it's really a continuation of the last section. It's an extrapolation of what was said at the end, that however the body is deported, one is aware of that. So these are the ways that that can occur. One is aware of these various activities of the body. And so the first thing we should take away from this section is an appreciation of each and every one of these. Going forward and going back, the commentary actually extrapolates this in meaning, for example, when a monk goes into the village for alms, which is actually quite apt because we do that every day. And so for us, it's a great meditation to start in the morning and go on walking meditation into the village, and then on the way back, do walking meditation back. And the commentary says that some monks are meditate on the way there and not on the way back, some meditate on the way back and not on the way there, and some meditate neither, and some meditate both. So the one that meditates on the way there and not on the way back is the one who starts off with good intentions, but then on the way back gets distracted by lay people talking to them and so on, and thinking about things that they have to do during the day, and so is not mindful on the way back. The person who is mindful on the way back but not on the way there is, for example, one who, because of not getting food in the morning, you know, on alms round, one can often be quite hungry. As a result, the mind isn't settled. But once one goes into the village and sits down and people offer the monk rice soup or this rice drink that they offer, then the mind settles down and they're able to take up the meditation practice. So on the way back, they can be very mindful. And then it says something quite interesting, that actually this rice gruel is actually quite useful for meditation. People can easily become enlightened because of it. So for tomorrow, I read that and I said, tomorrow, Manju, our steward, I asked him to see about making us some of this rice. Because when meditators come, it would be very useful for them in the morning to have this rice soup. It's something that is quite a benefit. So we'll see how that goes. But this could just as easily refer to something like walking meditation, when you're walking forwards and walking back and forth. It says abhikante patikante. It really means walking back and forth. In looking forward and in looking away from the front. So it means when you turn to look at something, or when you're looking up at something. There's an interesting story about this one, the story of this monk who was practicing very strong mindfulness. He was practicing the next section on, or one of the next sections on the parts of the body. I believe that's the next one, no? Yes, the next section. And he was walking very mindfully down the road, and he saw this woman came up, beautiful, well-dressed woman. And she saw him and she started laughing. She thought, what's this funny guy wearing these funny clothes, rags and so on. And she laughed and he looked up and he saw her teeth. And because he was so mindful, he thought right away of teeth. And he took teeth up as the meditation object. And her whole body just turned into this disgusting, revolting thing. And he gave up all attachment to the body when he realized that the body was just made up of these pieces like teeth that are like, well, we'll get to that in the next section, what teeth are like. There's a lot of fun we can have with the next section. Plants that have been sowed, or stones that have been set in a field, stuck into the gums, and bleeding, or blood and bone, you know. But this is quite important as well. For monks, we're not supposed to, when you go on alms round, you're not supposed to look at the person who's giving food. If it's a woman, you're not supposed to look at their face. And the commentary says that even when monks would greet each other, they wouldn't even when they were really practicing, they wouldn't even look at their each other's faces. They would just know that this is a senior monk, and so they would pay respect to them or so on, without even looking at them. Saminjite pasarite. This is the bending and stretching when you move to open the door, or when you pull a door open. When you open the robe up to pull your bowl out when people offer food. And these are all monk examples. But when you do, when you're driving your car is a good example. You turn the wheel or you step on the gas or so on. All of this is the extensions of the body, and being mindful of it is very much a part of our meditation practice. The other thing that the monastery, that the commentary explains about this section, and with all the sections, is trying to drive home what we're trying to do here, because really it can get quite monotonous and tedious and incomprehensible. What are we trying to do here? It seems ridiculous. You know, this all of this chatter that we've got, walking and bending and stretching, and it's like we're talking to ourselves. Point being that we talk to ourselves anyway, but the way we talk to ourselves is much more in line with our defilements and our desires and attachments and so on. Okay. But the point that we're trying to accomplish here is the realization of impermanent suffering and non-self, that these things are not me, are not mine, and the breaking away of all of our views. I believe this, I believe that, this is the truth, that is the truth, this is reality, that's reality, this is good, that is good, this is bad, that is bad, until we see that none of these are really the truth. They have no basis in reality. And so it explains each and every one of these in terms of what's really going on. In going forward, I'm not going forward. This is again the oscillation process, the wind element. In looking up, what is looking up? There's the straining of the neck, and then there is the eye. Then there's the touching of the light to the eye, and then there is the mental processing of the experience. And these things arise and cease. And it talks about what is an experience and the 17 thought moments and so on. That's not really so important, but it's interesting nonetheless. Bending and stretching, the bending is one thing, it arises and it ceases. The bending, the stretching is one thing, another thing, it arises and ceases. And this is important in the next part. It's an interesting add-on is in regards to wearing the robe, wearing the robes. When we wear our outer robe and the upper robe and so on, when we put them on, because this can be extrapolated to cover all of our possessions. In the meaning is in the use of our possessions. When we use something, not getting confused and misled to think that it is an object. It is me and it's mine and it's good and it's you know, wonderful, like our iPhones and our iPads and our computers and even other people and so on. Any our clothes, our cars, our houses. Seeing that these things are actually just a part of momentary experience. So in wearing the shoulder cloak, the commentary reminds us, which is a very important thing, reminds us that these things are not self. They're not me, they're not mine. They're actually not an entity, they're just an experience. Seeing the cloak, feeling the cloak. When you put the robe on, seeing it, feeling it, smelling it, when you haven't washed it, and so on. And the same with the bowl. Being aware of the bowl as being just an experience. Not clinging to the bowl as nice, as beautiful, as shiny as me and my... This is why monks are not allowed to have shiny bowls and beautiful colored clothes. Is because it very easily then leads us to become attached to them and to think that they're me and they're mine and they're good. And when they change, to think that they're bad and to become upset and give rise to all sorts of defilement. So a very important thing to remember, that what we're trying to do is to see things as impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. Basically, to see things as they are, because they are that in and of themselves. It's not intellectual that you have to think, is it impermanent? You just have to look at it, watch it, and whatever you see, that's reality. The point is, what you will see is impermanence, suffering, and non-self. It doesn't matter whether you believe that or not. Don't worry about it. See what you see. And what you see, that's reality, and that's important to see. Once you see that, then you can come back and think about it. Oh yes, that's what I saw, impermanent, suffering, and non-self, because that is what you'll see. You won't see permanence, you won't see satisfaction, you won't see self or controllability or entities. You'll see phenomena that or experience that arises and ceases. In regards to what is eaten, I don't like this actually. Let me see. Sitte, pitte, kaitte, saitte. I'm not sure about that. I guess it's correct in regards to what is eaten, drunk, chewed, and savored. The point being, when eating, no? I would rather say when you're eating. Although it is interesting, because the point that the commentary makes, that the point is to see those things as not me, as not mine, to not get attached to them. When you eat something, to not think, oh, this is me eating, and this is going to make me strong, and so on, and now I'm full, and so on. But the practice, the important practice, is the actual mindfulness when you eat. So we have this actually a mindful eating practice that we explain to people. When you raise the food, or here when you use your hands, you're squeezing it. When you raise it to your mouth, raising. When you open your mouth, opening. When you place it in your mouth, placing. When you lower your hand again, and lowering. When you close your mouth, closing. When you taste, saying tasting. When you chew, chewing. Being aware of that experience in that moment for what it is. It is this. This is what it is. Knowing this is this, that is that. And the next one is one of my favorite. I think it's one of the general favorites. Is the one about defecating and urinating. Now, why I say it's favorite is because it points out the extreme. It points out what we're really talking about here. We're not talking about sitting on a zafu in a meditation hall waiting for the Tibetan bowl to chime. No, we're dealing with reality. When you defecate, that should be a meditation. When you urinate, it should be urination meditation. That very important section, the section on defecating and urinating. There you have it. When uchara basava kamme sampajana kari hoti, which reminds us that it's for everything. When you're in the shower, you should be mindful. Yeah, whatever you do, when you're jogging, do jogging meditation. When you're typing on the keyboard, typing meditation. When you move the mouse, moving the mouse meditation. And then it goes back to the walking, standing, sitting, sleeping. In sleeping, now the commentary has something about the sleeping. The point being, in regards to sleeping, because when you're sleeping, you can't be mindful. But in regards to sleeping, you're mindful. And you're aware of the change from awake to sleep. So you're actually aware of the moment when you fall asleep. And when you wake up, you're aware of the moment that you wake up. And you see that the mind states that were involved with sleeping are not the same as the mind states in waking up. So in falling asleep and in waking up. So when you lie down to go to sleep, you should practice mindfulness. Watch the rising and the falling, or even just lying. knowing what's going on until you fall asleep. And as soon as you wake up, you should be aware of lying again or waking up and continue on with your meditation. So with both of these, you should be mindful. Not while you're sleeping, but in falling asleep is the point. In speaking, I have had arguments about this with people who say, "What do you do when you're speaking? How do you be mindful of speaking?" And this is a big problem because people, but it shows that people don't understand reality. They think I am speaking, right? If I'm speaking, how can I be meditating? It's not the case. You're not speaking. There arises the intention to speak, based on thoughts and so on, and then, based on that intention to speak, there arises the movements of the lips. And you can actually do speaking meditation. While the lips are moving, you can look at the lips, watch them, and say to yourself, feeling, or focus on the ear, the sound of your own voice. And you'll see that there's nothing there. There's no self, there's no me, there's no mind. These things arise and they cease. They're meaningless. In the beginning, it's quite difficult and it's uncomfortable, because you're trying to grasp and say, what's there? What's there? What am I looking for? You meditate thinking, when am I going to see this profound thing? And eventually you say, there's nothing profound here at all. What is this meditation? It's useless. And then you want to run away. I think this is wrong meditation. I'm not realizing anything wonderful or special or profound. And that's the most profound thing, is that there is no profound reality. Reality is impermanent, suffering, and non-self. It's not a cause for suffering, but when you cling to it, it makes you suffer. It means it's useless. It has no benefit for you. In that act of speaking, there is no profound and wonderful and exceptional entity. That act of speaking arises and ceases. You see, when I talk and you hear it, the other one is when keeping silent. So when you're listening to someone speak, for example, you're mindful of that as well. And if you're mindful of my sound of my voice, you say, hearing. In the beginning, you'll think, what? And there's nothing there. And you'll try to grasp it and really cling to the sound, until eventually you'll see that there's nothing there. The sound is nothing. Not exactly nothing, it's sound, but it's as close to nothing as you can get, really, because it arises and it ceases and it has no essence. Everything has no essence, which is the point. The last thing, the commentary does, the reason why it goes into so much detail is because it talks about four types of clear comprehension, four types of sampajanya. And I've only been really talking about one, which is, I can't remember, what's it called? Where are the four? Asamoha sampajanya, the non-delusion, which is really the meditation practice. The meditation practice is asamoha sampajanya, but there are four. Sataka sampajanya, I'll write these down in the comment. Where is the clear comprehension? Wait for the comment to be posted. Well, Hopefully eventually that'll be posted. So the four types of comprehension are clear comprehension of purpose, which means why you're doing something. So the other three really don't have to do with meditation directly, but they are useful. It's a good thing for us to mention them. Because in regard to your meditation, you have to still live your life, and you have to live your life properly. And I was joking about it, or not joking, I thought it was quite, I mean, it's not funny, but it's funny, but it's not ridiculous. The commentary talks about bending and stretching, how you have to be careful when you bend and stretch. You have to know why you do it. So don't bend for the wrong reason or stretch for the wrong reason. And be aware if it's proper to do so, and to do it at the right time and at the right place. So regards to sattaka sampajanya, which is the purpose, why are you doing something? So you only do things for purpose. Why are you doing this? You're clearly aware of why you're doing something. Why are you walking? When you walk for alms, you know it's for the purpose of getting food. When you look, it's for the purpose of seeing whether there's a car coming or so on. When you bend and stretch, you know why you're doing it, and so on. And it says that's why we get up and walk, because if we just sat still all the time, we'd get sore. So when you get sore, sometimes you have to stretch your body and so on. But you have to be mindful of it. When you're stretching, be mindful, stretching. Being aware of why you're wearing the shoulder cloak and the robes, why you're using the bowl. What's it for that you pick up the bowl? It's for getting food. And so what's for wearing the robe? Sometimes we put our clothes on. What are they for? And we think, oh, this robe makes me look so special, like a monk. You know, look at this robe, now I'm a real monk, and I look real cool in this robe. So on. Which is why we're supposed to wear rag robes, because then you look really cool. But no, the point being that we're not supposed to cling to it. We're supposed to understand what it's really for. As I said, the commentary goes into great detail, but I'll go over them here. Why are you eating? Why are you drinking? Why are you speaking? Speaking only when it's appropriate to speak. Defecating and urinating. It even talks about why you defecate and urinate. I mean, the point being, and it's very important. It's funny to read, actually, but it's incredibly important. To realize what this body is. It's not me, it's not mine. Because why do you urinate and defecate? It's because if you don't, as the commentary says, your eyes start to water, your body starts to shake. And you know, it's horrible pain, no? If you don't urinate and defecate in a timely manner when it's necessary. If you don't drink, you become dehydrated. Realizing that it's not out of a self-desire or the desire of a self. It's all based on cause and effect. And you give up self-desire, so you don't eat just for the sake of eating. You don't drink alcohol or so on for other purposes. The second one, sappaya sampajanya, is it suitable? Knowing the suitable, whether it's suitable to do so. So is it suitable to do this now? Is it suitable to go for alms here? Or is it suitable to go walking here or walking there? Is it suitable to do this, to do that? How is it suitable to do it? It's suitable to do it in this way and in that way. Being clear about what is suitable and how is the manner in which it is suitable. And the resort in regards to where it is suitable and which, in what cases is it suitable. The commentary gives this funny story about these. There was the monks were standing in the bhikkhuni, the male monks and the female monks were standing and listening to the Dhamma. And this one monk, he stretched his arm, he got sore from standing there, so he's kind of stretched out. And he accidentally touched a bhikkhuni, the male monk touched the female monk. And it says as a result of that touch, He disrobed. It was because of that touch that he became a layman. So it explains. It's a fairly good example. There's other examples of monks who would stretch out their arms and happen to poke a place where a snake was sitting, and the snake bit them, and so on. Very important, because it can happen. There are cases where you just a simple movement of the body. You know, here in the caves, sometimes when you're walking, if you're not aware of where your feet are and what you're doing, you can fall. And one monk here, he fell and broke his wrist some time back. Or no, he dislocated his shoulder. He fell and he grabbed on to the tree, and it dislocated his shoulder. So being clearly comprehend, but the point is to be without delusion. The fourth one is really the most important. It's the essence of the meditation practice. The others are obviously useful and important for all of us who live in our lives, to know why we do things, to know when is appropriate to do things, to know what sort of things are appropriate and not appropriate. And so this is these two sections really sum up the practice of meditation in daily life. They're quite useful for that purpose, for reminding us and for explaining to us and helping us to understand how to practice mindfulness in our daily lives. Point being that it then becomes a comprehensive practice, that then we are really living a meditative life. So I think I'll stop there. We've been going for at least an hour. And I'd like to say thank you to the person who set up our new server, and for everyone for showing up again. Even after all this time, there's still people following along. And I hope that it's been useful. And if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, at the top, we can go back up and we'll pay respect to the Buddha again. First, we will move the where we are section, and then we'll finish up here.